Hey, this is Colin. I'm in Portage Park, and I'm pretty sure that's a bat in the sky. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's Almost Above Ground audio magazine.
Hey, thanks, Colin. Stay safe out there, okay? Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's Almost Above Ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's wonderful to be here with you today for show number 958. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. And Bob Ferguson is on duty today in the WGN radio studio. He is our engineer, making us sound great on the air. And coming up on the show today, we learn about a new festival in the Bridgeport neighborhood that explores the stories of Black women and people of color. Also, we get the story of a very cool 80s rock band from the northwest side of the city and ask the question, why weren't these guys famous? And we get an update on the efforts to fight homelessness in Chicago. And speaking of homelessness, let's talk about something that is kind of disturbing. Earlier this week, on one of the coldest mornings of the year, city crews tore down an encampment in Gompers Park in the North Mayfair community, dismantling tents, tossing people's belongings, and leaving some of our most vulnerable neighbors out in the brutal cold. Now, there have been reports of some problems at the park recently. Since January 30th, there have been three fires there. A resident of the encampment said propane tanks being used for warmth accidentally caused the fires. Also, a neighbor's dog was recently attacked by an off-leash pit bull in the park. Block Club Chicago reports that, quote, Department of Family and Support Services staffers on site would not answer questions about why the tents were removed weeks before a planned accelerated moving event that would match encampment residents with housing. During a Wednesday news conference with Mayor Brandon Johnson, his chief of staff described the morning cleaning as an intermediate step before the March 5th accelerated moving event, end quote. I get that we want the park to be clean and safe. That makes sense. But we're also talking about human beings here. This should be a priority for the city. We can't turn our backs on each other, especially now. And especially now, we need local government to step up, since it appears that the federal government is dozing away many programs and people that can offer assistance to our residents. Now, the city says that there are resources available, that there are shelters with open beds, but it's not always that simple. Do we have a guarantee that the people displaced actually have a place to go, since the accelerated moving event was scheduled for March 5th? Look, the reality is people don't choose to live in tents in the dead of a Chicago winter because it's fun. They do it because they feel like they have no other option. So here's my question to City Hall. Why isn't there a priority plan in place to get people out of the cold and into some kind of shelter or housing? And if there is one, tell us about it. If there's money and manpower to tear down encampments, then there's money and manpower to provide real solutions, whether that's emergency warming shelters, permanent supportive housing, or even just basic respect for people trying to survive. We should demand better. We need leaders who won't just respond to homelessness with bulldozers and trash bags, but with compassion and action. Because at the end of the day, this city isn't just its skyline, its sports teams, or its food. It's the people. And I think that a basic compact between the city and its residents should be that we shouldn't let our people freeze. Homelessness continues to impact Chicago. Recent reports indicate a significant rise in homelessness within the city. Last month, in January, the city conducted its annual point-in-time count to assess the homeless population. Last year's survey found over 18,800 Chicagoans experiencing homelessness. Of those, just over 17,000 were living in shelters and about 1,600 were unhoused. And that number tripled 2023's count of people experiencing homelessness. All Chicago Making Homelessness History is a local nonprofit that collaborates with local, state, and federal agencies to provide emergency financial assistance, foster community partnerships, and utilize data analytics to develop effective solutions for ending homelessness. Carolyn Ross is the president and CEO of All Chicago, and she has been at the forefront of efforts to combat homelessness in our community, and she is here with us today and Outside the Loop. Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. A pleasure to be here.
Well, it's nice to talk to you. So homelessness, you know, when we look at the numbers, I am always surprised by the amount of people experiencing homelessness locally. I mean, it is staggering when you look at the stats. Can you just help us understand the significance of homelessness in our community? Because I think for some, we might not know the numbers, and maybe we occasionally see people who are unhoused on the streets or in Lower Wacker. But can you give us a sense of the significance of the problem here?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mike, for this opportunity. First, I would ask your listeners to just kind of widen the scope as far as what's considered homeless. There are many examples of people who are on the streets and who may ask for money or talk about their situation. But there are also a lot of our neighbors who are, you know, have lost their housing because of a loss of a job or loss of income in some way, having issues with health, having issues with just family members. We have a lot of related issues with domestic violence. And so I hope that people see that homelessness is the outcome of many different issues that people are struggling with every day. And so for us, no one should be on the streets. No one should be unhoused. Everybody should at least have that basic foundation of having a place to call home.
Yeah. And I think that sometimes we forget we're all of us are one catastrophe away from homelessness. So even if we Right. think this couldn't impact us, I mean, this is a very real thing that could really impact anybody.
Yes, yes, yes.
So when we say that we want to end homelessness, an easy solution, I think, is to say, well, hey, look, we just have to make sure that everyone has a place to sleep. And certainly we want that, right? But this is a more complex issue. And so that gets into how your organization, All Chicago Making Homelessness History, goes about its mission. I mean, the way that you're involved in the community, I think, is really important, and how you build partnerships. So if I ask you, you know, how do you go about your mission? Really, I think it's a combination of strategies, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We have a multitude of resources, but collectively, that's where the strength is. And so for us, we can't do this work without our partners, without partners on many different levels, in neighborhoods, at the government level, people making policy, our business community, our philanthropic community. All of those are very key partners to be able to say, hey, I have this piece of the puzzle. Can you bring yours in so we can try to address this? And we've talked about one of the key things that guides to homelessness is just the lack of affordable housing. And I know people kind of get caught up in that sometimes and say, well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Well, when your rents are beyond what you can pay, that's unaffordable. When you are working and you have to take on a couple of jobs or find money to bring into the household just to pay your rent, and you're still short, that's not plausible for many individuals and families. So that's why we talk about the housing issue so much. But even furthermore, you know, in the last decade, we've had a couple of different nationwide challenges that have affected all of us, quite frankly. We've gone through a pandemic. We had a surge of new arrivals that came into the city. And now we're just trying to adjust to a new administration. People are people, and we are all going to struggle about something at some point in our lives. And so wouldn't we all like to have that hand up, to have somebody available, even if it's just someone to talk to? So our focus is really to try to make sure that whatever resources we can compile are not only available, but people know about them, know how to access them, because we're not trying to save anybody. We want to give people the tools that they need to be successful in managing and sustaining their own lifestyle, their own households, and be able to have that pride in in being a part of the city. And so that you're right, it's very complex, because without judgment, we've got to sit down with you and say, what led you to homelessness? And then help you develop a plan to address that so it doesn't come back as an ongoing issue. Because the goal is that homelessness should be rare and non-reoccurring. We don't want people to return to homelessness after they receive services.
And each situation is different. There's no one-size-fits-all approach, I think, when we're talking about individuals and their own situations. And, you know, thinking about how this housing situation fits into the broader mission of what you do at All Chicago, one program that your organization has that I've discussed before is the Chicago Rents Initiative. And basically what this does, it connects Chicago landlords to tenants who previously were not in a position to rent because they couldn't afford it. So remind us of how this works and how this initiative is going so far.
Absolutely. Well, there are many different services that we provide at All Chicago. I mean, the primary service is to get people housed and to help support them in that effort. And so Chicago Rents was one of those initiatives we started just to help strengthen that effort and to help recruit and bring in folks who, quite frankly, this may be part of their business. This is a way that they bring in extra income to support themselves and their families. So it's about connecting with partners, partners we've had for a long time. The first thing is to help with what you asked me at the beginning of this discussion, which is, do you really understand what homelessness means? Who is affected by homelessness? And how do we not allow those any stereotypes or any, you know, thoughts that are not really supported to not get in the way of housing people? So we've got over 500 property partners. These are landlords who either have a couple of units to rent, all the way up to property management companies. And for people that we're working with, if there are resources to help them with subsidies or to be able to help them make that rent, that's our goal. And furthermore, we want to make sure that if they're placed in housing, that they're able to be able to afford it themselves at some point. So not only Chicago Rents, but we address issues like employment and income. If there's someone addressing issues with addiction or mental health issues, those challenges, they need to be addressed and need to be part of the plan. The big part of this is making sure that people understand that whatever your thought is. For example, I had a conversation with a landlord one time who said, Carol, I just don't want to have drug addicts in my building. And without being curse about it, I mean, the reaction for me was, you may have already leased or are currently leasing to someone.
Sure.
They don't come to you with you knowing this beforehand. And our goal is to make sure that both parties are happy. Good tenant makes a happy landlord. Good landlord makes a happy tenant. And we want to make sure that they both on both sides feel very supported. So we're really proud of the program because it just helps strengthen the efforts that we already had out there. And with the shortage of affordable housing, quite frankly, we need all the help we can get.
Yeah. And 500 folks involved in that program. That's a really great feat. And I know the work continues. And I have to ask you this, Carolyn. I mean, you rely on support, information, not necessarily money, but information, guidance from the federal government. And look, this is a time, I think, of a lot of uncertainty when it comes to government. How have you been navigating the last few weeks with everything coming out of Washington, D.C., and kind of the chaos that's been going on? How's this impacted what you do?
It's a great question. I mean, first and foremost, let me acknowledge the challenge. And everybody is going to be affected by it at some point because change is hard for people. What is not acceptable, though, is when decisions are being made that affect the lives of people without regard for the outcome that they will experience as a result of some of those decisions. First and foremost, we are going to keep moving forward because we have a job to do. When people are struggling and they're trying to find housing or some type of settlement in their lives, they need us to do this. And I say that in the sense of, if you're coming to us and you have issues of your own problems, we have to make sure that at least we're on point with the focus and our mission. So we're going to continue, along with all of our partners, to continue to do this work and try not to allow this to be a distraction. Having said that, though, part of our work as being a lead of the homeless response system here in Chicago, kind of imagine us as the hub of a wheel, not the spokes, but the hub, in the sense that with all of our partners at the city, at the state, the federal government, all of our provider partners who provide these services, case management and housing placement, we're connecting with all of them. We're having conversations with them, trying to keep things level as we possibly can. And then more importantly, we're reaching out to legislators. We need them to understand the impact that some of these decisions could be harmful to folks who are already starting this. So, of course, you heard that the federal government shut down access to federal funds. For most, it has reopened. We're going to keep going forward. But that immediate decision to do that, understanding that there's an assessment going on and trying to rearrange things, you can't have no gas in the car and continue to get around, right? So we need our legislators to understand, no matter what the change may be, this is detrimental, not just to the homeless population, to people all throughout this country. And so we have to advocate for that and to let them know. People can't do anything if they don't know. But I do think we'll continue to see some challenges with us. No matter what, we're going to keep going. People still need us, and we want to get people housed as quickly as possible with the resources that they need.
Well, this is vital work, what you're doing to end homelessness in Chicago and beyond. And this is a human issue. We can look at the numbers and the data. That's all very important. But I just like to remind us that when we talk about this stuff, we're talking about people's lives here and human dignity. And we can check out the website for your organization at allchicago.org. Carolyn Ross, the president and CEO of All Chicago, making homelessness history. Carolyn, thank you so much for your time. I know that you are very busy right now with everything going on. So I appreciate the time and really keep doing what you're doing, because we need it here in Chicago.
Mike, I'm so grateful. Thank you to you and to your efforts to get this messaging out. It's something that we all need. And I want all of our partners out there to know how much we appreciate them, because we cannot do this work without them. And let families and individuals know, don't give up. There's still hope out there.
In the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
That was in my younger days. Now the city's changed and so have I. But yet there's still a place to go where I can leave my...
Oh yeah, once again connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip, in the Chicago Reader, online at chicagoreader.com. He's also a local musician and an artist and a music historian. And Steve, this week, a little bit of some shredding going on here with a band called Ruffian. Awesome.
These guys, yeah, it's, you know, they never released anything, so it was pretty cool to get their story, actually. And yeah, they were just like a kick-ass band that could have easily been on the charts, you know, in the 80s when you see the kind of chops and tunes and sort of personality that they had.
Yeah, and keytar. We'll get to that in a little bit, but there's some keytar involved. And whenever you're breaking out the keytar, stand by because it's about to get real. So this band Ruffian, you talked to Nick. We're not quite sure how to pronounce his last name, but we're going to go with Syhogios. We'll just call him Nick. But he's kind of like the founding dude of this band, Ruffian.
Yeah, well, so there was an earlier incarnation called Stagger. And that actually, I saw a picture of that band on the internet, and maybe Nick had posted it, and I was like, whoa, those guys look heavy, you know, and they had a cool logo. So Stagger, he was sort of brought in. They were kind of a pre-existing band, and he was brought in by his buddy. And, you know, and this is just in the burbs of Chicago. This was in Norwich. Yeah. And, that area.
Elmwood Park. That's where I grew up, man.
Yeah.
That's my town.
All right. A little Elmwood Park. Hey, you know, I'm from Northwest Burbs myself. So, you know. Yeah. So, you know, just sort of high school, you know, he sort of auditioned for the band, but came together. And him and his buddy John were more like rockers. They were totally into like Sabbath and Uriah Heep and stuff, which I was very happy to hear.
Oh yeah.
And you know, but, and then the other guys were, he said, you know, we're kind of coming from more like a CTA, Earth, Wind and Fire kind of vibe, but they all like good harmonies. And you know, I thought about it and I'm like, you know, this is kind of how polished 80s rock came together, maybe. Is this how it happened? Was this the peanut butter that fell in their chocolate, or, you know, chocolate that fell in their peanut butter, and was like, is that how it happened? You know, like, they came together and created this form, but...
Vocals were the key. That was the glue.
The harmonies, you know, harmonies and having strong vocals and, you know, probably hooks as well, you know, kind of brought them all together.
Yeah. So a couple of the band members, like I said, come from Elmwood Park High School. Some folks from Norwich here. So really, we're looking at that kind of Northwest side area.
Ridgewood High.
Oh, yeah. Of course. So Stagger, this is the early incarnation of the band Ruffian. So they are starting to play out. They're playing the classic Thirsty Whale. You know, I feel like so many bands that we've talked about have played the Whale.
Totally.
And it was a great spot. So tell us about how they sort of come together and they start to gig out here and they try to make a name for themselves.
They really sounds like they hacked it out as hard as any band ever did. Yeah. You know, they like bought a van, it wouldn't start, the place wouldn't fix it for them in time for the tour, so they went in and grabbed a starter out of another van. I love that. They lost so much time that they ended up like driving the entire way to the West Coast, you know, like without stopping. I've done that one. And not the stealing of the starter, but I did to Montana at least in one haul, and boy, not fun, you know. But yeah, you know, it sounds like they worked hard, and then they end up doing this sort of residency in Hawaii for like 3 weeks, and that is where they sort of heard, you know, the sort of incoming you know, sound of like Journey and Kansas and Boston, you know, and those harmonies, and you know, there's a little bit of soul music in there, there's a little bit of hard rock in there, you know. So like they started kind of going in that direction, and then they finally sort of found a manager and sort of upped the game a bit and became Ruffian.
What a great name for a band. So as the band Stagger, they're opening for some pretty big artists. Tower of Power, Dion. They are opening for the Ramones. I guess they become Ruffian at this point. But so they're really, you know, getting out there and they're showing people, hey, we can play. We're good. And so they get this manager. He says, change the name. They change it to Ruffian. And what happens after this? Because they get some notoriety with some label action.
Yeah, so, okay, so this manager guy, Joe Crispino, so it sounds like he was pretty connected. He was connected to A&F Records and somehow, and then he started getting them bills. So they're playing bills. They're playing with the Ramones at, like, what, UIC?
Right? University or of Chicago.
University of Chicago.
1983.
Thinking they're going to bomb, but they were high energy and tuneful enough that people dug them, you know. And then they're also opening for Bryan Adams, you know, like on this early tour at the same time, which is, in, you know, that's kind of a spectrum. And it was all because of this sort of manager connections. And then, you know, they were able to record better demos, including this one at Pumpkin Studios, where like Styx recorded and all these bands. And then Crispino somehow gets it in the hands of, this is a little bit of a detour here, Paul Anka.
So, okay, Paul Anka, who apparently, from what you write here, has a lot of power, a lot of connections.
Can we just say Paul Anka was kind of a baller?
I never would have thought.
You know, I picture him now. Maybe I could see him with a pinky ring being like, kiss the ring, you know. But he's actually Lebanese, Paul Anka.
He has so many connections. So, okay, this manager gets Ruffian connected with Paul Anka. Where does this story go after this?
Well, he does a thing that is just so classic in the biz where he's like, you guys are going to, you know, I don't know what he's telling them. Like, you're going to be the next lover boy. You know, you're going to be the next Toto. I'm going to go fly you to my hairdresser. I'm not making this up. You know, like, I'm going to fly you boys into my hairdresser in the West Coast. We're going to get you back. We're going to get one of the most famous rock photographers over here to take, you know, pictures of you. You know, he's telling their wives, like, you know, your boys are set, you know, in the industry and stuff. And then he does nothing. And he's got like a production company, and, you know, and he had invested, they recorded like in his home studio and basically had an unreleased album. They're hanging out with guys from the Dooley Brothers who are playing on some of the tracks. And then he does nothing.
Yeah. So, okay. Paul Anka, what the hell? He takes this band kind of under his wing. He is literally flying them out, you're right, to his hairdresser, and then flying them to the photographer, and then to gigs or whatever. And they record in his studio. And so he then just doesn't do anything with the recordings.
No. And then, you know, this is always the other sad part of all these, sadly, a lot of these same stories, is that they're locked in like a contract, you know, where they can't really do anything else either, you know? So it's like, you're in limbo. And like, this has happened to friends of mine's bands, you know, who like had bigger producer guys take them on their wings. And, you know, I don't know if you're just like a tax write-off, but, you know, the industry just, it's cruel, and they get distracted by something else that's going to make, you know, they got more dollar signs and they go with that, you know, or It's fickle, as we know, you know, the music industry. So, yeah, they had to kind of scramble and sort of like go back to playing, you know, like a cover band for a while to just sort of make ends meet. And then, you know, to their credit, Nick and a lot of the guys, they've been playing in bands and music together ever since.
So they basically, Ruffian, this band here that we're talking about from the northwest side of Chicago, they decide to call it in like 1984, early 1985, around that time. And they were under this contract. And you have this quote that Nick says, he says, "For all I know, we still might be under contract, but I really don't care."
Yeah. at this point, you know, you got to let it go, I guess. But yeah, it's nuts. There's just so many sad tales in the music biz. And that's when you really sort of shake your head and go, why, you know, like, this band clearly given, and so, you know, getting to the keytar, as you mentioned, yes, earlier, this band could do it all. There's footage of them. Well, there's a really cool Facebook page, Whatever Happened to Ruffian, that Nick runs, with tons of photos and links to songs that didn't come out and videos and stuff. You should check it out, and what he's doing today. And there's like footage of them auditioning, and they're like just showing off their instrumental chops, and holy cow, the keytar comes out and it gets serious. The guitar shreds, and like they're all like clearly like insane stellar musicians, and it's also very of its era. You know, you hear it, this could only have been made, you know, in this, you know, time of like 1982 or whatever it was. And then there's also songs, you know, that they did in the studio, and you're like, wow, this is just the right amount of polish and hooks and you know, rockiness to have been on the radio with anything at the time. You know, some of the demos they recorded at Pumpkin Studios and such.
So the keytar, for those who don't know, you've probably seen it. It looks like a keyboard, except you wear it over yourself like a guitar, like a strap. And it's a keyboard. You're just playing it facing the audience, as it were. And that's the keytar, and it's awesome. I'm a fan of the keytar. I think you are too, Steve, and that's a good thing. But
I used a session keytar player on my last record.
See, that's what we need more of.
I'm not lying. It's true.
That's great. Well, Nick is still playing. He's still gigging out. So he's doing some solo stuff, and he's still very much entrenched in music here.
Yeah, I mean, he's had bands ever since with some of the same guys in the band. Joe Zito, a guy who was in the band, he had one called Abdul's Cactus Remedy. That was like in about 2009. And they had another one called Chicago Hitmen. Sounds like they might reform on occasion. They started about 2017. And then I believe currently he is Chicago's own piano man who does Billy Joel and Elton John covers, I believe.
Ah.
You know, he is still a hard gigging musician. And then he did an album like just a couple years ago of originals called It's Never Too Soon to Start Over. And man, he's just like kept going and started over a zillion times.
Well, the band is Ruffian, and they're coming out of the Northwest Side, and they're shredding. They're awesome. And you can get the full story in the Secret History of Chicago Music strip in the Chicago Reader. Steve Krakow is the author of that strip. He's also a musician, music historian, and artist. Steve, as always, sir, I appreciate your time and all of your hard work. And let's just air guitar together, right?
You air guitar, I'll air keytar.
Seems she's always on my mind, and I have to take some time to let memories have their way back to yesterday.
The inaugural Chicago Women of Color Puppetry and Performing Arts Fringe Festival is happening now through March 16th. This groundbreaking festival spotlights artists addressing critical themes such as activism, human rights, and social justice. It serves as a platform for underrepresented communities, especially women of color, to showcase both new and evolving works. Jacqueline Wade is the founder and executive producer and the artistic director of the Chicago Women of Color Puppetry and Performing Arts Fringe Festival, and she joins us to tell us all about this ongoing event. Jacqueline, welcome to Outside the Loop.
Thank you for having me.
You are quite welcome. I appreciate it. So this is pretty cool. This is exciting. This festival, like I said, is running now, and it's going through March 16th. And this is at the Joe B. Arts Center at 1029 West 35th Street in Chicago in Bridgeport. So tell us why you started this festival. Why did you create it?
Okay, that's a really good question. it really all started with coming, being invited to be part of the Chicago International Puppetry Theater Festival lab. And what that was at that time, they were bringing different artists who had concepts of different shows they wanted to create. And it sort of was a incubator for you to evolve your piece for about, I believe, 9 or 10 months. And that's what brought me first to Chicago. It wasn't just me developing a story, but it was also me building the puppets, collaborating with some other people, not with the story, but I was basically the lead fabricator, meaning builder, and sculptor on all my puppets, especially my giant John Africa puppets. And at one point in the process, especially in the rehearsal process, I had mostly, which was okay, cisgender white women, which was fine, right? Because that's what was there. And one of the members said that they felt really kind of funny about playing some of these BIPOC people. And it wasn't all BIPOC, you know, puppeteers, you know, but a lot of them were. And so what happened was that a few of them decided, because of that, they didn't want to basically be part of my show. Okay, so I started asking around, you know, especially the powers that be, you know, who can we bring on, you know, and there really wasn't a big network of BIPOC puppeteers, and those that were there basically wanted to be paid, you know, quite well because they were professionals and, you know, respectfully, I understand that. You know, they didn't really have that connection. So I you know, I said, I want to use the community people. So I ended up working with unhoused individuals who were part of an organization called Red Line. And that was the best thing I had ever done, was working with these people. Most of them had never had any, you know, experience working with puppetry, building, or anything. So it's like bringing them in. Some of them had just gotten out of prison, you know, had just been through hardship, real hardship. So I learned through them and they learned through me. And so I figured, okay, let's do this social justice thing. Because that's where my mind has always been. I don't, you know, I think fairy tales and things like that are fun, but I often think that there's messages in everything that you can do.
In the themes that you're talking about here, you know, these are themes right now that I think, you know, it's an interesting time with what's going on in the world. You know, these themes, how do they, do you think now are relating to the current political climate? I would imagine that there's some discussion about, you know, Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and women, and how does all this factor in?
I mean, if you have a government, okay, or elements of a government that is very negative towards you, okay, that affects your psyche, and it brings back other trauma, okay? A festival like this explores who you are. You know, what I find, and I'm going to deal especially with the arts, but specifically with puppetry, is for me, it's creating something from nothing. As someone says, I can't wait for you to give me what I need. I have to go out and get it myself. I have to go out and read the books. I have to bring in the experts I need. So that's, it's also about creating institutions for us, by us, so that we can feel in charge and empowerment.
So what do you hope the impact of this festival is on the larger society when people can come to Bridgeport and check this out? What's that bigger impact?
Well, I think, first of all, it's definitely about diversity, equity, mm-hmm. inclusion, okay? And I'm talking not just race and gender, everything, LGBTQ, all of it is there, whether you want to see it or you don't. I think it's really important in a place like Bridgeport, considering what its history was, and to now have, and we're not the first in there, but to make it a more annual thing, if possible, I think it opens it up. It brings more and more people of diversity and to bring in other perspectives. And that those who may think a certain way, you know, some of the conservativeness of some of the individuals who are in that neighborhood, maybe they'll come and see it. It's also bringing in other people into that neighborhood, you know, to know that they are welcome. That like every time people would say to me, especially when I would get into an Uber, do you know where you are? Why are you living here?
Wow.
You know, and I'm like, yeah, I figured it out. I definitely figured it out. And I understand things have changed, but some of the old heads are still here, you know? So, yeah, I'm hoping that it opens people up, this new administration. There's a lot of things happening that are tearing people apart on all levels, gender, race, economics, everything. You know, people are really stressed right now. And it's like, okay, well, I'm shocked, you're shocked, you know. Okay, so let's come to place where we can see things, where we can process things, where we can get moving and starting to not just, you know, these things are happening to us and just watching it like it's TV. No, the festival is social justice. It brings attention to things of the past, things of the present, and things of the future, because as I believe, history repeats itself over and over and over again.
Well, the festival is happening now through March 16th at the Joe B. Arts Center at 1029 West 35th Street in the Bridgeport neighborhood of Chicago. And the website is ChicagoWomenOfColorFest.com. And lots of really important themes that this festival brings out through a variety of performances and art. And Jacqueline Wade is the founder, executive producer, and artistic director of the Chicago Women of Color Puppetry and Performing Arts Fringe Festival. Jacqueline, I really appreciate the time. Congrats on this festival, and best of luck with everything in the future.
Thank you.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop, show number 958 is done. Thank you, as always, for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson, our engineer on duty in the GN Radio studio. And I hope you have a wonderful week. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.